chapter 18, verses 1 through 3 tonight. We'll maybe bump into verse 4 a little bit toward the end, but mostly we'll be in 1 through 3. I'll go ahead and read those. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, Fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Now, chapter 18 is still part of the seventh bowl judgment, and the focus is on Babylon, both economic and religious Babylon. And both of these, the economic and the religious, have a common thread, and that is that within this system, both economic and the religious, man is ultimate. Everything is done in the self-interest and for the self-interest of man. It's what drives everything. It's the idolatry of self, of which the world is the primary means of gratifying this idol of self. This is what Satan did to appeal to Eve, remember? He appealed to her with the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the boastful pride of life, that the fruit looked good and it was supposed to taste good and it was desirous to make one wise. So the whole temptation was basically self-gratification, self-exaltation from and by means of and through what was forbidden. So the world is really an entire system in which man is the ultimate. He's the center. It's not the hills, the trees, the lakes, the rivers. That's not the world that the Bible speaks of as the world, usually, when it's speaking of the wickedness of the world. Rather, it's the world system, the way it thinks, its values, how it forms its judgments, everything. And whereas man is the center of the universe. In fact, all wars, all conflicts, everything is all a result of self-interest in man being absorbed with self-interest. Remember what James said over in James chapter 4, verse 1. What is the source of quarrels among you? Is it not your pleasures that wage war in your members? Is not the source the pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world, that is this whole world system that focuses on self-gratification, is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. And so this is what has dominated mankind. And of course, Satan pursues his own self-interest. He is the ultimate in his own eyes. His desire is to usurp God in everything, to be the ultimate object of worship. This is what he told Jesus, right? Bow down and worship me, and I'll give you all of this. All the power, all the influence, all the riches, all the prestige, all the honors, all the glory that comes with all this will be yours. And of course, this was an appeal and a temptation to Jesus' humanity. Certainly not his deity, but his humanity. But because Jesus in his humanity had nothing with which Satan could tempt him, it was not a temptation for him. But for the average human being, this would be a great temptation. And so the fundamental principle of all false religion is self-salvation, which is really just self-worship. And so men will deny the one true God and his salvation on his terms, and substitute it with a salvation that man initiates by his own power, where it's by his ability, his effort, his wisdom that he secures his own salvation. Now, this might be through a ritual or a ceremony like baptismal regeneration. It might be through ethical behavior, being more moral than other people. Maybe through education. Maybe just through their own free choice apart from the work of God to cause it. You make the choice. God makes the change theology. Or in our culture today, it just simply could be, I went to church one time in my life, so therefore I'm a Christian. And that's it. And I think I am, therefore I am. And so man becomes his own savior. And becoming his own savior, man becomes emancipated from the dominion of God. His rule, his commandments, his principles, his precepts. So man is now free to establish his own standards for right and wrong, good and evil. What is Christian, what's not Christian? He can establish his own forms of worship and his own forms of godliness, his own definitions of what church is and what constitutes church, his own definitions of sin and what is sinful and what's not, even his own definitions of God and God's will. He can substitute or he can institute his own definitions of success, his own definitions of happiness. And today we've come to where man now can define marriage on his own terms. He can even define what is male and female on their own terms. And it's all in relation to self. And when self becomes so highly exalted and becomes so elevated as the object of worship, it will tolerate no denial of self. There will tolerate no inconveniencing of self. Nothing which makes self feel bad can be tolerated because self is ultimate. And this is the religion of Babylon. This is religious of Babylon. Going all the way back to Genesis 11 with let us make a name for ourselves in building the tower. So it's all self-worship, self-exaltation. And this is the system that has dominated the world, all world empires, all cultures, all people, since the fall of man. And since almost immediately after the flood. So self-worship, worshiping the creature rather than the creator, exchanging the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, Romans 1, 20 through 23, and worship that image. And this is the system that is being dealt with here in Revelation, the system of the harlot, this Babylonian system. And the beast and the ten kings, as we saw in chapter 17, turn on this system. Even though they've been in cahoots together with the woman sitting on the scarlet beast, not in dominating, but rather one supporting the other. It's a mutually beneficial relationship. But now the tables are turning. And it's because the beast will no longer tolerate any competitors. No other religion. Not the religion of self, nothing else. And so in chapter 18, John is shown a new aspect of Babylon's fall. And it's economic Babylon's fall. Where in chapter 18, verse 1, is introduced with, after these things I saw. This is introducing a new vision. And it's the destruction of the economic prosperity of this system, because it's the primary means, this system that of economic prosperity, using the world as the primary instrument of self-gratification. That system is coming down. That's the first thing that is attacked. Now chapter 18 is divided into three sections. It's verses 1 through 3, which is the announcement of Babylon's fall by the angel. Then there's verses 14 or 4 through 20 that is a prediction of the fall by the voice from heaven. Verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven. And then verses 21 through 24, which is a second announcement by an angel of the fall. So when John says, writes here in chapter 18, verse 1, after these things, he's describing something that's next in a series. It's a new vision, a new situation. Well, what's new about what's taking place in chapter 18 versus what occurred in 17? In 17, the guilt that's described there, the guilt of the harlot, is primarily a spiritual adultery, as we saw in verse 4 of chapter 14. She had in her hand a cup, gold cup full of abominations and the unclean things of her immorality. It was this spiritual adultery, spiritual abominations, spiritual immoralities. Whereas in chapter 18, it's her worldliness, her sensuality, and her association with luxury and self-indulgence and ostentatious wealth. And of course, this just led to her arrogance. Chapter 18, verse 7, to the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. So it just led to this pride, a proud self-exaltation, self-indulgence. And of course, one leads to the other. Now, some people try to avoid these natural consequences by maybe engaging in some sort of extreme asceticism, that if they deny themselves this, deny themselves that, then therefore they're less worldly and less fleshly and less likely to be caught up in the pride and everything else that goes along oftentimes with wealth. But that's not what the Apostle Paul said. Remember over in Colossians chapter 2, verse 23, when he says, why are you submitting yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with the using, in accordance with the commandment and teaching of men? These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom and self-made religion, self-abasement, severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. So, just pure raw asceticism is no guard against the arrogance, the self-exaltation that comes from this ostentatious wealth. In fact, over in Ephesians, you remember, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 3, part of the characteristic of the unbelieving mind is that it was indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind. And so there can be a fleshly indulgence, self-gratification, not only the flesh, but of the mind. Now, both of these aspects of the Babylonian harlot system, both the spiritual and the carnal, are in opposition to God. In fact, remember James said, to be a friend of the world is an enemy of God. To be a friend of the world, its system, its way, its thinking, its values, its priorities, is to be an enemy of God. Over in 1 John, remember 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, John describes the world. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but from the world. It's from this world system, this harlot system, this Babylonianish system that exalts self. All of that is from the world. It wants to act independently of God. So chapter 18 is describing this internal collapse of this economic Babylon that's in partnership with the beast system. Remember, the beast supports the woman. But now, he wants everybody to look exclusively to the beast, to him. See, Satan will no more tolerate the worship of the world over himself than God will tolerate the worship of something else over himself. He wants ultimate authority, ultimate control, ultimate devotion. And Satan will use the world to entice people away from God into the worship of him, but he wants them to worship him, not the world, and not what he uses to entice with. And so the beast reaches a point where he no longer needs the woman. He no longer needs this world system to entice people into a devotion to serving him. Now, all world empires collapse from within before they collapse from without. And so John is showing here a new aspect. And that new aspect is the economic collapse of Babylon. John says he saw another angel. This is not one of the seven bowl angels, but it's a different angel. He is a great angel. He has great authority, and the earth is illumined with his glory. Now, some have tried to say this is Jesus. Well, this is not Jesus, because Jesus is not another angel. This word another there is the Greek word allos. It means another of the same kind, same rank, order, authority. Jesus is not another angel, because angels are created beings. Jesus is not a created being. All an angel's authority is derived authority. It's not intrinsic to them. All Jesus' authority is intrinsic to himself. But this one is great. And he's great that he's sense that he has great authority. He's able to make his voice heard. Over in chapter 14, verse 8, we were told of an angel flying in midair with an eternal gospel. And then a second angel in verse 8, a second one following, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." And so it's a similar announcement being made here. But the fact that this angel has great authority, and in verse 2 is crying out with a mighty voice, it's impossible to miss the message. It's impossible for anyone to miss the warning. It's impossible for anyone to ignore his voice. In fact, there's not going to be any excuse for not heeding this warning and this announcement. Now, we have to just marvel at the grace of God that he would send an angel to announce this message to the world at this time, when he's already given us his word. He's already given us his complete and full word, his full revelation. Of course, the Bible, by this time, anything remotely connected with God's word, has probably been banned by the beast. But this angel's voice is the first of a series of voices that draw very heavily from the Old Testament description, not only of Babylon, but also of Tyre and of Nineveh. All of these were major economic world powers within their time and in the sphere of influence where they were. And of course, we see many of these Old Testament references. We can look at some of them over in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 21. An announcement against Babylon. Chapter 13 is all prophecies against Babylon. But in verse 21 it states, "But desert creatures will lie down there, their houses will be full of owls, ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged." So it's a pronouncement of judgment on Babylon. Again, Isaiah chapter 34, verse 14. And the desert creature shall meet with the wolves, the hairy goat also shall cry to its kind. Yes, the night monster shall settle there and shall find herself a resting place. In other words, it's just going to become a place uninhabitable by man. Also, Isaiah chapter 47, verses 7 through 9. Yet you said, I shall be a queen forever. And these things you did not consider, nor remember the outcome of them. Now then, hear this, you sensual one, who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know loss of children. But these two things shall come upon you suddenly, in one day, loss of children and widowhood. They shall come on you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. And you felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you. For you have said in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. That is the spirit of Babylon. That is the Babylonian system, the harlot. I am and there's no one but me. And of course there are passages in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, Nahum. Nahum itself is just simply the entire book of Nahum is devoted to prophecy of the destruction of Nineveh. You have Zephaniah chapter 2 that deals with the destruction of Tyre. And so you have these first voice and then you have second voice that give two reasons for God's judgment. And the first in verse 3, the first reason is for all the nations are drunk of the wine and the passion of her immorality. In other words, the first reason is political self-interest. And this political self-interest and political power is being gained by wealth and exploitation. And then, verse 23, the second voice, gives another reason, and that is toward the end of the verse, for your merchants were the great men of the earth because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. In other words, it's materialism, self-indulgent, economic self-interest. So the angel announces with a mighty voice, literally a strong voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Now, the verb tense of fallen there is the aorist tense. It's indicating a point in time. In other words, this is not a slow decay over a long period of time, but it's sudden, all at once. Just like Isaiah said, in a day, in a moment, you'll experience loss of child and widowhood. It's going to be a total sudden economic collapse. Over in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 46, speaking of Babylon, states, at the shout, Babylon has been seized, the earth is shaken, and an outcry is heard among the nations. And Jeremiah 51, verse 8, suddenly Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Bring balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. So it's a sudden destruction. And it states that what her condition is, she's become a dwelling place of demons, literally a habitation of demons. Again, over in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 38, states, a drought on her waters, and they will be dried up, for it is a land of idols, and they are mad over fearsome idols. And of course, we are told that behind every idol is a demon. So this is a land that's just consumed, that is just filled up, a habitation of demons, of just idolatry of every kind and sort, which of course is what's going to happen in society. And in a time when self-worship is at its highest and the world is the primary means of gratifying that self and self-worship, everything becomes an idol of which to serve that desire for self-worship and self-gratification. And so it's just filled with idols everywhere. It's become a dwelling place of demons, and then a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Again, just indicating basically just demonic, wicked, evil spiritual beings. And by calling it a prison, it's indicating that the word literally means a place where something is watched, a place where something is kept under guard. It's also translated a haunt. It is a haunt of every unclean spirit. And the fact that it's a prison means that they're more than likely there involuntarily. And it's everything evil and unclean is there. All of it's to be found in this Babylonian system, especially the economic system. This woman, why? Because she's the mother of harlots, right? And so everything is going to be found there that leads to this sort of idolatry and harlotry. And then verse 3 gives the reason for Babylon's fall. Because all the nations, and the word nations, there's ethnos, where we get our word ethnic group from, or ethnicity. In other words, all the nations, every ethnicity, every people group, every nation, without exception, all of them have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. None are exempt. All have united with and partaken of, drunk from her cup. They've all been a part of her system. They've all imbibed it. Peoples, kings, merchants. In other words, all mankind is morally and spiritually bankrupt. They are anti-God and pro-man. Pro-self. Hostile in mind and actions. And John says that they have drunk, or the angel is announcing, that they have drunk. Perfect tense, indicating an action that occurred in the past with results that continue right up to the present time of the writing. This is something that all nations have done, and the effects of it just continue on. Just continue to go on. And they've drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. The word can also be translated anger or wrath. In other words, it's just describing a passionate self-indulgence, a passionate preoccupation with self and self-gratification and self-indulgence and the elevation of self, and the anger, the wrath, and this passion can explode in anger and wrath if that self-indulgence is ever frustrated. Remember what James said? James 4:1? You don't get what you want until you murder. You actually go to the extent of murdering. That's how inflamed the anger becomes when self gets frustrated. And when there's such an exaltation of self where people think they actually deserve all these things, and when they don't get them and can't have them, they just go nuts. And so they're intoxicated with self-gratification. and this independence from God and faith in the earth and its in the world and its inexhaustible resources, in their own ingenuity, their own intellect, their own abilities to be able to get and create all that they want to gratify their self. They have no need to depend on God. Therefore, they have no need to obey His word or follow His commands or trust His promises or heed His threats and warnings. So this is what everyone has done. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, this passionate self-indulgence. And the kings of the earth committed immorality with her. Again, all sorts of immorality. All to woo her. All to gain her wealth. Their pleasure, her luxuries, her power. So they compromise with her. They'll make ungodly and immoral alliances for political and economic gain. And human suffering is of no concern, just as long as they can make a buck. I remember watching a documentary one time on John Muir. He was somewhat strange, but a naturalist, but he would say, nothing is safe from which somebody can squeeze a buck. Nothing is safe. Whether it's Yosemite National Park, whether it's natural resources, it's whatever. Man will pillage and desecrate anything. Nothing is safe from which man can squeeze a buck. And that includes the church. That includes Christianity. That includes the message of the gospel. So there's nothing that they won't use to advance their own political self-interest, these kings of the earth. They'll even adopt her opposition to God and His word and His commands and His law. Because if all that frustrates their own selfish desires and self-gratification. Because see, wealth is a means of gaining and exercising power. You've all heard of the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. That's these kings' philosophy. Now these kings are going to suffer less than the merchants in the collapse, this economic collapse, because they still maintain their political power, but the merchants are going to lose everything. The merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. The word merchants there, it's a compound word, literally means one who's on a journey. It's used over in Matthew 13, verse 45, for the merchant who went out looking for a pearl of great price. And they're going out, they're searching, they're scouring, they're trading, engaging in business. This is not just your mere mom and pop store owner, retailer, tradesman. These are people with far-flung interests. These are the movers and shakers of the earth. And they become rich. Remember the rich young ruler. There was the foolish farmer who said, I am rich. We're fine. I got stuff stored up. And it just means to have an abundance. Well, how did they become rich? By the wealth of her sensuality. Literally, it's by the power, the dunamos, the power of her sensuality. And the word sensuality there, it's the only time it's used in the New Testament. It can mean wantonness. It's just an arrogant, self-indulgent luxury. Remember James again? You ask and you don't receive. Why? So you want to spend it on your pleasures. It's just this arrogant, self-indulgent, self-gratification at the expense of anything and anyone else. So they become rich by the power of her sensuality. Her sensuality is power. Power to enrich the merchants. They can sell a self-indulgent lifestyle, prosperity, affluence, financial independence, security. They will appeal to people's greed and lust, which again just amounts then to idolatry and a pride in wealth. Remember when Paul was writing to Timothy in some of his final instructions, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17 through 19, Paul told Timothy, instruct those who are rich in this present world, that is, they were already rich when they became Christians, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, because that would be idolatry, right? So fix your hope on that, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. So right there's the warning not to be conceited, proud, arrogant, and to fix their hope. Don't let their riches lead to this pride in their wealth. This is what has occurred with the merchants. See, false religion and promises of self-fulfillment, self-gratification, prosperity, a better life in this world, accumulation of material possessions. These things and false religion usually always go hand in hand. Man is ultimate. It's a man-centered theology, a man-centered Christianity, a man-centered gospel. And it all revolves around man, which is the system of the harlot, this Babylonian system. Why do people immigrate to America, for the most part? I mean, you have some people who are fleeing political or religious persecution. Those often have a hard time getting in. But people come to America so they can worship the one true God and give Him all the praise and the glory that is due His name, and to submit themselves to His Word, to His law, and to His commands, and to put their trust and faith in Jesus Christ. No. They come to America because of what it promises, right? America's luxury has great power to attract people, to bring people, to hold people, to seduce people, to ensnare them in a worldly way of life. And this is what the merchants, they become rich by the power of this luxurious, or this hope and desire for this luxuriousness and sensuality and material prosperity. That's what they're selling. Well, let me just touch on verse 4, and we'll get into a little bit more next time. But there was another voice, another angel, another voice from heaven. Doesn't say it's an angel, just a voice, saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her signs, and that you may not receive of her plagues. And this is a message in the New Testament, all through the New Testament, right? Come out from her. Remember what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial? What has a believer in common with a believer? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God, just as God said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate, says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean. And that's a quotation from Isaiah 52:11, which is again speaking of the destruction of Babylon. Come out from their midst and be separate. Also Ephesians. Remember Ephesians chapter 5. We just covered it this past week. Verse 6. Let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. And Ephesians 5:11. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it's disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. So the voice is saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, so you can, and that you may not receive of her plagues. So you cannot participate in her sins and not receive her judgments. God will not separate. And sadly, this is what the vast majority of the church today, professing Christendom today, doesn't seem to understand. They're unwilling to come out and be separate. They're unwilling to not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness. They try to be friends with the world, to integrate the world, assimilate the world, to participate in their sins. They want a Christianity with no distinction between the life of a professing Christian and that of the generality of the people and the culture in which they live. And it's hard for people to come out because her sensuality has a great power to hold and to instill a fear of losing it, of separating from it too much. But that's not the message. It's to come out. Because if you don't come out, you're going to participate with the sins. Because there's no way to stay in and not participate. And if you participate, you can't avoid receiving its judgments. So that is not a message just for the people in the end times and the great tribulation. That's a message for professing Christians and for the church today, is to come out and be separate, distinct, set apart, a holy people for His own possession, to where there is a great distinction between dark and light.